Sponsorship of this KQED podcast is provided by Menlo Park Dental Excellence, providing general dentistry with quality care to all patients, serving patients one at a time with no triple booking, flexible hours Monday through Saturdays, mpdentalexcellence.com.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org. And URS, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical support to public agencies and private companies. URS.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, why four Republican members of Congress from California are changing their positions on a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants. And forging bipartisan support for immigration reform, has Silicon Valley gone too far in reaching out to conservatives?
I don't care where you sit in the boat. If you're pulling an oar in the right direction, fantastic. I don't care where else you are going for the rest of your trip.
Those stories plus in waters off Santa Barbara coast, paddling to help kids in need.
We are going to be paddling about 11 miles with about 120 kids. It's kind of like organizing cats to raise money for a little boy with a life-threatening illness.
Also, how a beloved flea market is threatened by San Jose's real estate boom. It's the California Report. And we begin today with a bit of a bind for California's Republican congressional delegation. They're grappling with a dicey question, whether or not to legalize millions of undocumented immigrants. Citizenship is the hot-button make-or-break issue on the path toward comprehensive immigration reform. As KQED's Arthi Shahani reports, at least four of California's 15 Republican congressmen are breaking with the GOP leadership on this key question.
Republican Congressman David Valadeo answers my question without hesitation.
Do you support legalization?
Yeah, I support a path to legalization. That's not an issue. We've had a broken immigration system for decades.
We're in Bakersfield, a city divided between two congressmen, Valadeo, a junior member who's been in office just 7 months, and Kevin McCarthy, the Republican whip and his senior by far. Yet Valadeo is on McCarthy's turf, headlining a town hall at the Bakersfield Christian Church. Legalization means getting a legal visa and, after many years, full U.S. citizenship. On stage, Valadeo tells the audience he's pushing for it.
I've been meeting with McCarthy. I've met with Cantor. I actually spoke to the speaker 2 days ago.
Valadeo is not alone. He's standing beside Congressman Luis Gutierrez, the Illinois Democrat who's such a pro-immigration diehard, he got himself arrested protesting President Barack Obama. Local Latinos pack the room to hear him, and when Gutierrez raises his fist and says it's time for the Republicans who control the House
and the Speaker of the House, Mr. Boehner, to allow a vote,
Valadeo is among the first to clap his hands. Three other Republicans, Devin Nunez and Jeff Denham of the San Joaquin Valley, and Paul Cook from the northern Mojave Desert, also say they support legalization so long as it comes with strict border and visa enforcement. Angelica Salas heads the Los Angeles-based immigrant rights group CHIRLA, which organized the town hall. Salas says the state's GOP is changing. She's encouraged because they sound friendlier now than the last time Congress took up the issue.
In 2006, the California Republicans were the ones who were our strongest adversaries. Bill Bray, for example, who's no longer in office in San Diego, was the head of the Immigration Reform Caucus.
Republican Brian Bilbray and his caucus pushed bills to strip citizenship from babies born here to undocumented parents. He lost his seat to a Democrat. Salas credits two changes. First, redistricting. The GOP controlled redistricting across much of the country. In California, they didn't, and they lost 5 seats in the House last year. Second, race. The state's Latino voter base is growing rapidly, and polls show they overwhelmingly support a path to citizenship for the undocumented.
What's happening in California is representative of what could happen to Republicans across the country.
A lot of my people have buckled under. Who wants to be called a racist? Who wants people to say that they're mean-spirited, nasty people?
Republican Dana Rohrabacher has represented Orange County for nearly a quarter century. He remains outspoken against legalization. He fears his colleagues are caving to illegal border crossers and the powerful high-tech and agriculture lobbies who want cheap labor. California Republicans Daryl Issa and Gary Miller, for example, are now showing signs of softening their hardline stance against comprehensive reform.
I think a lot of our people have sort of hesitated to step up and be as aggressive and passionate on this issue as they should have been. And if they would be, the political situation in California and elsewhere would be totally different.
The Republican whip back in 2005 supported a bill to criminally prosecute undocumented immigrants and the citizens who aid them. Today's whip, Kevin McCarthy, is staying quiet, even though he could sway a lot of fellow Republicans. McCarthy did not respond to repeated media inquiries. Rohrabacher's take?
Now, with Kevin, Kevin's tried to be a little bit more flexible and not being quite as yes or no type of situation. I think he's left a lot of maybes on the table.
Ira Melman, spokesman for the Federation for American Immigration Reform, opposes legalization. And Melman says if it passes, the Democrats will get the credit.
What the Republicans seem to be doing, or at least some of them, is pandering in the expectation that if they jump on board the amnesty bandwagon, that they're going to attract significant numbers of Hispanic voters. And there really is no reason to believe that that's going to happen.
Maribel Olvera brings her parents, both undocumented farm workers, to the Bakersfield Town Hall. Olvera is meeting her congressman, David Valadeo, for the first time.
I did not know he was for immigration reform, so I'm really shocked right now. Very excited.
Did you vote in the last election?
I did.
Did you vote for him?
No, I did not.
Does this change anything for you?
Maybe. There's some other issues, but yeah.
Olvera sounds enthusiastic and hesitant. How House Republicans hear her voice will shape their own voice on the issue. For the California Report, I'm Aarti Shahani.
It's no secret that California's agriculture industry relies heavily on migrant workers, but so do high-tech companies. Out of self-interest, Silicon Valley has long pushed for higher limits on H-1B visas that allow foreign-born techies to work at places like Google and Intel. But now, high-tech companies are pulling out the stops for immigration reform, convincing Republicans and Democrats that now is the time to do something big. Led by Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg, the tech sector created a bipartisan advocacy organization called Forward US. It has just one priority.
Right now, we are all focused, all hands on deck on immigration reform.
Rob Jessmer is campaign manager for Forward US. Jessmer comes with sterling conservative credentials. Until recently, his job was electing more Republicans to the U.S. Senate. Now, he's sharing an office with people who helped reelect President Obama.
We have a Republican House, we have a Democratic Senate, and we have a Democratic president. So right now, if you want to get something done in Congress, you have to work with both parties. Some Republicans have a hard time understanding that. That's true if you're a Democrat. Some Democrats have a hard time understanding that.
Forward US is working behind the scenes, lobbying key members of Congress, including ones facing tough re-election battles in states where immigration reform and President Obama are not very popular. As part of that strategy, the group bankrolled glossy TV ads, like this one with South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham, criticizing Obama's energy policies.
And the president says, "I'm for all the above when it comes to energy." Those are words coming out of his mouth. They don't come from his heart. No Keystone Pipeline, no drilling in the Gulf.
That ad and others like it stirred up a firestorm from environmental groups. They objected to an advocacy group with Silicon Valley roots extolling what they call dirty energy projects that would contribute to climate change.
Mark Zuckerberg and Forward US should be able to push for issues they care about without throwing environmental priorities under the bus.
That's Jeff Gorringer with the League of Conservation Voters. In protest of those political ads from Forward US, they pulled their ads on Facebook for 2 weeks.
You can't take two steps forward on immigration reform and then turn around and take two steps back on environmental priorities, which are things that Facebook should really care about, and Mark Zuckerberg as well, as a true innovator that cares about climate change.
But Silicon Valley political operative Wade Randlett doesn't see it that way at all. Randlett raised big money for Barack Obama and other Democrats. This week, he was in Washington lobbying for immigration reform, and he's more than happy to join people with whom he disagrees on other issues, including green energy.
I don't care where you sit in the boat. If you're pulling an oar in the right direction, fantastic. I don't care where else you are going for the rest of your trip.
Randlett says getting something major done on this issue in this political climate requires lots of strange bedfellows. Groups like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and Organized Labor, who support immigration reform for very different reasons, ranging from family reunification to economic competitiveness.
We've got everything from Forward.us to Catholic bishops working on this issue and everybody in between.
Silicon Valley's emergence as a political player has been gradual. In their early years, high-tech companies avoided the federal government, hoping they'd just leave them alone. Eventually, their lobbying focused on issues of direct concern, like industry regulation, protecting intellectual property, and H-1B visas. But their current involvement signals a fundamental shift, says Dan Schnur with the Jess Unruh Institute of Politics at USC.
Because what we're seeing now is Silicon Valley interested and involved in advocating for issues, not only those that impact their own bottom line, but rather those that have a much broader and more sweeping impact on American society.
Schnur says it's significant that Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg took the lead in creating Forward US, taking up the mantle of first among equals.
In the 1990s, it was Bill Gates. In the first decade of the 21st century, it was Steve Jobs. In this decade, it's Mark Zuckerberg. And what Mark Zuckerberg does professionally, commercially, and politically tends to define how the Valley is going to act in those areas.
Monday night in San Francisco, Zuckerberg and Forward US will wade further into the immigration debate. At the screening of a sympathetic film about the lives of illegal immigrants, Zuckerberg will introduce the director, who is himself undocumented, a nod to the more liberal part of a broad coalition supporting the most comprehensive changes to immigration law in nearly 30 years. Every summer off the Santa Barbara coast, dozens of kids take to the water in support of children facing devastating illnesses. The event is called the Keiki Paddle. Diane Bach recently attended this year's relay and files this report.
Fishing vessels, dive boats, pleasure craft, and inflatables set off from the Santa Barbara Harbor and head up the coast. After half an hour, the captains cut their motors and drop paddle boards and kids over their sides.
Guess what you're looking for, to jump in the cold water early in the morning, huh?
Barkley Bastian cheers on his daughter, Jordan. It's early, just past 9 a.m., and the water is a chilly 64 degrees. But that doesn't dampen the enthusiasm of the Keiki paddlers. Keiki is the Hawaiian word for child, and the Keiki paddle is all about kids helping kids.
Paddle. We are going to be paddling about 11 miles with about 120 kids. It's kind of like organizing cats. to raise money for a little boy with a life-threatening illness.
19-year-old Tavis Boyce has been involved with the Keiki paddle since it first began in 2006. That was the year his mom, who had cancer, was the beneficiary of the Friendship Paddle, the Keiki paddle's parent organization.
She passed a few months afterwards. It means the world to me. I mean, this is like my life in a bubble right here. It's kind of like all like my hopes and dreams and like every, like my whole past is just kind of, you know, boiled down to this paddle every year.
At the halfway point, the sun burns through the fog and the ocean becomes glassy. A curious seal pops up and takes a look around before slipping back into a kelp bed.
Hey, Keiki paddle, looking good!
Parents in support boats, many are members of the Friendship Paddle, offer encouragement, snacks, and the occasional tow. But for the most part, the kids complete the paddle under their own steam, happy, smiling, and laughing throughout. 3 hours after they begin, they reach their destination on the beach. A celebratory spray from the Harbor Patrol's firefighting boat greets the paddlers. Riding along with one of his best friends, beneficiary Samuel Helfand leads the group to an emotional landing on the shore. Samuel is 7 years old. He was diagnosed with spinal cancer last fall.
This is just incredible emotional support. It's paddle power.
Samuel's mom, Heidi Helfand.
Samuel's been visualizing how all the energy from the paddles is just going to destroy his tumors. Everywhere we turn, we see a familiar face. We see people supporting us. We see kids that have built relationships with Samuel, who he just met. They taught him how to stand up paddleboard. It's a lot of encouragement, a lot of positive energy. It feels great.
Jason DeMizio, a tall, athletic 15-year-old, is a veteran keiki paddler and one who's experienced this event from both sides.
I had a brain tumor when I was 7, and it grew back when I was 14. I had surgery on it twice, and so they decided to make me the beneficiary for last year's keiki paddle. I was excited that they picked me, a little nervous, but it was cool. It meant a lot to me.
The beneficiaries are chosen by the Keiki Paddles Junior Advisory Board, a group of teens who organize and run the event. Board member Chase McFadden.
I got involved with the keiki paddle kind of on the early side because my dad was the original beneficiary of the friendship paddle. He had an inoperable brain tumor.
Chase was 7 years old when his dad's friends organized the first friendship paddle. His dad died 2 years later. Now Chase is 17.
It was kind of my way of giving back after receiving so much love and support. So this allows me to maintain that connection by making the contribution to future recipients of the keiki paddle.
Each keiki paddler commits to raising at least $150 in pledges. The board's still counting this year's pledges, but last year's paddle raised $20,000, and the board hopes to top that this year. For the California Report, I'm Diane Bach in Santa Barbara.
Journalist and author Gary Camilla was born in Oakland and raised in Berkeley, but for decades he's called San Francisco home. In his new book, Cool Gray City of Love, 49 Views of San Francisco, he scrutinizes his beloved city, trying to explain why he and many others are so crazy about it. The California Report's book critic Oscar Villalone has this review.
If we're honest, San Franciscans like myself have to admit that we can be insufferable about our city. We nakedly adore it, sometimes to the point of rudeness. People in Oakland and L.A. can only roll their eyes when we babble like giddy teenagers about living here. In his book, Cool Gray City of Love, 49 Views of San Francisco, Salon.com co-founder Gary Camilla does his fellow San Franciscans a favor by charmingly and thoughtfully laying out why this particular swath of 49 square miles inspires such fervor. A seasoned journalist, Camilla is clearly in the tank for San Francisco, which he describes as a soaring sandcastle built where the tides come in, 1,000 white pennants waving from cathedral spires, the last place to have a drink before America stops and the endless ocean begins. As he investigates all of the city's various landmarks and features and relates his personal connection to them, Camilla is more often than not awed by what he encounters. People and places are described as remarkable, magnificent, marvelous, glorious, and so on. Yet, when Camilla describes the trails hugging Land's End, or the actions of various citizens in the fiery aftermath of the 1906 earthquake, those adjectives prove apt. Even while he channels the invincible enthusiasm of the late Huell Hauser, Camilla isn't shy about exposing the troubling flaws and the lasting shames of his beloved home. Throughout the book, he relates the city's long history of disgraceful treatment toward its non-white residents, a history stretching back from centuries ago to today, encompassing the Ohlone, African Americans, Japanese, Chinese, and Mexicans. And as Camilla makes clear, the city has a record for being hostile toward the poor and the working class, and now toward its middle class too. Yet, San Francisco remains alluring, if only because of its unimpeachable beauty. Camilla explores its hills, beaches, cliffs, lakes, canyons, and vistas. We learn the geology behind them, and we get a good sense of why they exalt those who behold them, from the area's first settlers, who lived here for millennia, to today's techies snatching up homes in the Mission District. And its history offers legacies to be proud of, too. Most recently, there's been the nonconformity of the Beats, the optimism of the hippies, and especially the courage and the resourcefulness of the LGBT community amid the horror of the AIDS crisis. In the end, Cool Gray City of Love wants to capture what it means to be blissed out by San Francisco and does a solid job of that. But it's really about something bigger. It's about having something in your life, no matter where you live, that makes you glad you're alive.
Oscar Villalone is the managing editor of the West Coast literary journal Ziziva. He reviewed Cool Gray City of Love, 49 Views of San Francisco by Gary Camilla. California Stars may well be the most famous Woody Guthrie song he never recorded. The iconic songwriter died in 1967, but some of his songs found new life 30 years later, after his daughter Nora uncovered thousands of his unrecorded lyrics. She got in touch with British singer Billy Bragg and the band Wilco, who put music to many of these unheard tunes. As part of our series California Songs, Nora Guthrie shares how one of the most popular recordings of this modern collaboration came together.
My dad only recorded, you know, maybe 150 or 200 in his lifetime. He wasn't a big recording artist. We uncovered all these lyrics, and I felt like they were meant to be sung. That's when I got in touch with Billy Bragg and Wilco. I like to rest a heavy head tonight on the bed. The California stars, I like to I think a lot of people come in and say, oh, where's the next Pastures of Plenty? You know, where's the next This Land is Your Land, etc. So you kind of dismiss some of the stuff. And when that's what happened with California Stars. And I had seen it a few times. And I was like, eh, you know, kind of a love song, California Stars. I wish I was back home again. And it was complete, like, surprise when they came out with that music. And suddenly that lyric had a lot of power to it. I like to dream my troubles all the way out of bed. California stars jump up on my starbed, make another day underneath my California. Woody spent a lot of time in California. He went out there on numerous trips. He went out there right during the Dust Bowl period. This is the love song that came out of California. There's something about the tempo and the vocal and the melody that they did that brought out this idea of a little bit of melancholia. Maybe a lot of people resonate with that little dream that you can just have some place where you can go and relax and get away from it all, where you can rest your weary head. I'll tell you, when I first heard it on the radio, I just remember sitting there like, oh my God, it seemed a little slow when I first heard it. I'm like, this is awfully easygoing. And then I realized that they were doing it at a pace in a way that everyone could sing along. Even if you weren't singing out loud along, you were just singing along inside yourself. Yes, I give my life to lay my head tonight on a bed of California stars. He wrote This Land is Your Land right after he, like a week after he left California as he was traveling across the country. So he was really in his prime, you know, that prime, like hormonal period of your life when you're getting it, like things are starting to make sense and you know where your place is in the big picture. And that's what California did. I would think it was like a real, very fertile ground for his mind and for his songwriting.
That's Nora Guthrie talking about her father Woody's song, California Stars. You can find it on the 1998 album Mermaid Avenue by Billy Bragg and Wilco. And finally today, the San Jose Flea Market is one of the largest open-air markets in the country. It's been in operation since 1960. But with San Jose's real estate market booming, the land the flea market sits on is now coveted by developers. Guy Marzorati has this postcard.
On a sunny Sunday afternoon, more than 30,000 people roam through the San Jose Flea Market stands. Vendors sell fruit cups and vegetables, along with hundreds of piñatas, longtime staples of the market.
Get it.
A mariachi band plays in the distance as vendors vie for the attention of perusing shoppers.
San Jose's flea market is the best place to come shopping when you want to get a good deal.
San Jose resident Richard Holland's been coming to the market locals call La Pulga, the flea in Spanish, for 45 years. Today, he's shopping for produce and a stereo. Nearby, a man peddles his homemade car wash serum. He claims it erases tree sap, bird excrement, and other tough stains. He rubs it into his shiny white Mustang as the crowd looks on.
It's great because it's an institution. It's been in San Jose. It is the ultimate business incubator for small businesses.
Brian Bum owns and manages the flea market. He sits at a picnic table in a shaded area filled with shoppers breaking for lunch. His father originally purchased the land in 1958, and he believes the market captures the entrepreneurial spirit of Silicon Valley.
On any given day, for $35, you can come out and sell and test your business acumen, or you know, sell your garage stuff and supplement your income, and it's great for that.
That opportunity may end when Bay Area Rapid Transit, or BART, opens a new station bordering the flea market site in 2017. Developers are eyeing the 110-acre plot for new housing and office parks. The city of San Jose's 2040 development plan envisions the same future for the site, with no mention of the flea market. Many vendors who rely on their sales for more than just supplemental income criticized the plan and hoped La Pulga would relocate. Longtime shopper Richard Holland likes the idea of BART in San Jose, but thinks some of the city's residents would suffer if the flea market is pushed out.
Big revenue loss, big loss for San Jose in general. I mean, it's a lot of jobs here, too. A lot of seniors, a lot of people got a lot of work here.
Anna Gonzalez sells Mexican food and groceries. She's noticed a decline in the number of shoppers in the last year and fears that even if Bum sells just a part of the market, fewer customers will come to her stand.
We are scared about that because we don't have any other career.
Joseph Horridel, the city's director of planning, says it's up to the Bum family to find a home for the market.
It is not something that the city sees that is our role to provide a location or to recreate that, that this is a private activity.
Owner Brian Bum plans to keep the flea market in its place when BART arrives, but an offer he can't refuse may be on the horizon. In fact, to maximize the price of a potential sale, he changed the land's zoning designation to allow for residential units. A housing development will break ground in September on an unused 10-acre piece of the market that Bum sold to a developer. The units are expected to go on sale next year, and as the burgeoning real estate market pushes for the development of housing in every nook and cranny of the region, San Jose's sprawling bazaar may be lost forever. For the California Report, I'm Guy Marzorati in San Jose.
And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director is Susie Rocho. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman. The online team includes Chad McClymans and Don Clyde. Our interns are Carly Naren and Rachel Marcus, who produced our California song. The associate senior producer is Victoria Malione. I'm Scott Schaefer. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. The California Teachers Association, celebrating 150 years of advocating for all students, educators, and California's public schools and colleges. And the California Endowment, Health happens with prevention at calendow.org.